A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on SIM. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 44. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of A for Andromeda. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. So A for Andromeda, 1961 BBC black and white series in 7 parts, written by a very famous astronomer, Fred Hoyle, a hard science fiction show about a group of scientists working on a new radio telescope, which receives a strange signal from a distant galaxy, which directs them to build a supercomputer, which in turn goes on to create a new life form in the form of a young woman referred to as Andromeda.
And in addition to this 1961 serial that we discussed quite a bit in our last episode, the BBC also produced The Andromeda Breakthrough in 1962, a year later. A for Andromeda was very popular and a critical success. They averaged over 9 million viewers per episode and 12.9 million viewers for the final episode, which were really quite large numbers at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, quite astonishing numbers. And I suspect part of its success was it was about 2 years after the last Quatermass, Brian. I think Quatermass in the Pit was about 1950.
Yeah, 58, 59 was Quatermass in the Pit. So this was a couple years later. And definitely a replacement the next thing after Quatermass.
Yes, I think that there was that feeling at the time that this was the next Quatermass. Because I think when you and Xander discussed it on British Invaders, Quatermass sort of invented event television in the 1950s, the sort of television that everybody was talking about. And there was groundbreaking stuff in A for Andromeda. I mean, we discussed the character of Madeleine Dornay, this very senior female scientist, with really quite an advanced role in the whole sort of team and project, but with nothing at all, no reference at all to the fact that she was a woman in what seemed to be otherwise a man's world. So that was quite interesting. And of course, we had early mentions for things like DNA. I mean, Watson and Crick's discoveries about the structure of DNA were less than 10 years old at this point, so we had I think quite early mentions on television for it. So quite a lot of interesting stuff.
That's right. The science was very important to A for Andromeda. It was sort of the linchpin that everything else rotated around. Because it was so groundbreaking and popular and something so unique at the time, the BBC rushed to commission a sequel and really went after this. The director of A for Andromeda, Michael Hayes, had actually told the BBC that they should keep their lead actress under contract for a sequel. The central actress, who was Andromeda, the being, the life form created by the computer, was Julie Christie, who was quickly becoming quite a name and was clearly very good. This was still a few years before her big breakthrough in Dr. Zhivago. But while she was originally intended to continue the role in The Andromeda Breakthrough and actually started to do a bit of work on it, the contract and the negotiations fell through and they were not able to have Julie Christie in The Andromeda Breakthrough.
Which was a bit of a gaffe on the BBC's part. This is very, as you say, is very young Julie Christie, right at the start of her career. And she is quite stunning looking. And she sort of captures that sort of almost otherworldly presence of this character Andromeda.
Yes, she does.
Yes. And I mean, you know, it was clear. I mean, you could see that she was destined to go on to great things in Hollywood. And the BBC had a chance to get her for the sequel and missed it. So in the sequel, The Andromeda Breakthrough, she's replaced as Andromeda by another actress. Again, another very attractive blonde actress, Susan Hampshire, who's gone on to a fairly successful career, particularly on British television over the years. Although she gives a slightly more sort of human, I think, performance as Andromeda compared to Julie Christie's sort of alien interpretation.
That's true, although that was something that worked in the plot and the story of it quite well. And she did look very similar to Julie Christie, so it is a pretty smooth transition as these things go.
Yeah. And we have also, we have Peter Halliday returning as Fleming, and we have Mary Morris returning as Dornay, and they'll both be sort of key to the plot of the sequel, The Andromeda Breakthrough, along with Susan Hampshire as Andromeda.
And again, we have Fred Hoyle and John Elliott writing. And it was directed by one of the writers, John Elliott, and by John Knight.
And so the story of the sequel, presumably, they must have been, once they realized the success of A for Andromeda, they must have been casting around for something to hang a sequel on. And the part of the original story they sort of ran with was this subplot about this mysterious organization called Intel. This sort of, as you said, Brian, a sort of European corporation, but they're also slightly mysterious. There's sort of political intrigue and industrial espionage going on. The Intel organization effectively kidnap the characters of Andromeda and the scientists Fleming and Dornay and take them to a sort of fictional Middle Eastern country called Azaran, where a lot of the story will take place.
Yes, Azaran is a very sort of totalitarian, small tin pot regime that Intel pretty well has in its pocket. Part of what was happening in this story, right from the beginning when Fred Hoyle was working on A for Andromeda, he was thinking about the idea of, well, what would a country other than Britain do with something like this? And this is where we come to the point in the story where a duplicate computer is built by Intel. And this is related to Intel being so powerful as an organization that they actually had access to other telescopes, and they had received the original message as well.
That's right. So we've got a second supercomputer in this Middle Eastern country, which is, as you say, effectively run by this strange organization, Intel. And that really sort of kicks the story off of the Andromeda Breakthrough, and we're sort of away from there. We've got a variety of strange events going on, in particular that the world's weather system appears to be altering, in particular that the air is becoming thinner, and so much so that it's threatening human life. And while this is all going on, we've also got the character of Andromeda herself, who, as you say, Brian, as played by Susan Hampshire in the sequel, is starting to become more human and more sympathetic to humanity. But at the same time, she's also apparently becoming more susceptible because the Andromeda starts to become unwell herself. And whether or not she will survive seems to be tied into the fate of the planet in a way.
And also we start getting the ideas about what happens when Andromeda starts coming in contact with the second computer. You get to lots of things about the original signal and, again, the purpose of the signal and whatever intelligence is behind it. And there are hints about the intelligence, but you never see little green men. You never get to see what the actual nature of the alien intelligence is. But you do get more hints about it and more things about some of the things that happened during that original process that happened when they first were going through the process originally before Andromeda had been created at all.
It lets them muse a bit on the sort of the role of science, I suppose, isn't it? There's a fair bit of discussion about what is the role of science and scientists amidst all this political and military wrangling and intrigue that's going on. And there's some interesting stuff there, I suspect, lots of it from discussions between the writers, Fred Hoyle and John Elliott.
Yes, there's definitely some interesting stuff there. It's, again, quite complex.
And we've got the advantage, of course, because the sequel, The Andromeda Breakthrough, has survived in its entirety, so you can watch the whole thing, which is six episodes this time.
Yes, that does make a big difference.
Intel are efficient. You remember I was wondering if there was anything special about the seawater in these parts?
Is there?
Yes, it's like this.
It's opaque.
Normal seawater should look like this. Quite clear. Mm. Now, see what it does. Still clear, yes?
Yeah.
They got me other samples, too.
Oh. Kaufman trotting around the resorts with a bucket and a test tube.
Eastern Mediterranean, Western Mediterranean, East Atlantic, Bay of Biscay, North Sea, Irish Channel, Skagerrak, the Mint.
Now, there were other versions of A for Andromeda, which we'll touch on briefly. Fred Hoyle adapted both A for Andromeda and the Andromeda Breakthrough into novels, which I think the first one, A for Andromeda, was published in 62, so the year after the first series, and again, the Andromeda Breakthrough in 1964.
I believe he collaborated with John Elliott on those as well.
Right, so Elliott was involved in both of those, right. And they're still available, I believe. They're certainly in second hand, and I think the original novel is still available, is still in print.
In the UK.
Right. Oh, sure.
It's not in print in North America, although there has been an American printing of A for Andromeda. So those are available in used bookstores and the like.
They are still fairly readily available, I think, both of them, aren't they?
Yes.
And as we've heard on our Facebook group, I mean, we have to give thanks to Tony on the Facebook group for pointing out, because I didn't think either of us have read the novels, but that they do apparently expand on some of the ideas, and they also do help, particularly the first novel does help with some of the elements of A from Andromeda, which we sort of are lacking because of the fact that much of it doesn't survive, unfortunately. I suspect also, I mean, I'm not sure about this because I couldn't find the exact details, but I do have a memory of A for Andromeda and the sequel both being read as books of the week on BBC Radio 4 during the 60s and early 70s. And so I suspect they did crop up there from time to time.
Right. I've heard that the novels were actually quite close to the original scripts before they had been padded out, with some more things in them as you get with novels, but that they're a little more faithful to that as opposed to the television versions.
Right.
There was a remake of A for Andromeda for Italian television in 1971 and 72 called A Com Andromeda that was 5 60-minute episodes, apparently quite faithful to the original version, and it is available, but there are no English subtitles on it. It's in Italian. So I haven't watched it myself because I don't understand Italian, but apparently it is quite similar to the original, and it does survive in complete form.
Okay, and then sort of coming bang up to date, in 2006, the BBC remade A for Andromeda in a modern version with the actor Tom Hardy playing the Fleming role. Tom Hardy, perhaps best known for playing the bad guy in one of the Star Trek films, Star Trek Nemesis. The young actress Kelly Riley played Andromeda and brought that sort of otherworldly, sort of strange beauty to the role. And then Jane Asher played Dorne, although they sort of combined, in a way, I think, the roles of Reinhardt and Dorne into one scientist played by Jane Asher. Again, another quite interesting actress who's going to crop up again in British Invaders in the future. Although, interestingly, I gather that the production team actually wanted to get Julie Christie to play the role of Dorne in this version, but she was unavailable. Fortunately, Jane Asher was able to play the part and did a very good job.
Yes, she did. It was made by the same team that a year earlier in 2005 did a remake of The Quatermass Experiment, in both cases for BBC, and they were sort of working on this idea of doing a series of modern remakes of these older serials that had been lost, or in the case of Quatermass, not even recorded because it was a live broadcast. The remake of A for Andromeda was boiled down to about 85 minutes. Now, if you remember, the original was about 45 minutes by 7 episodes. This is quite a bit shorter, and it doesn't have quite the same emphasis on the science. In particular, a lot of the process of receiving the message, decoding the message, following the instructions, bringing in Dorne as a biologist, and going through this whole process of discovery and creation, that was much of it left out, which in some ways was too bad, but they did bring us an interesting look at A for Andromeda in a modern setting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, in a way, it's a shame that this particular television production company didn't carry on with this idea of sort of modern remakes of BBC classics. I'm not sure what they would have moved on to after Quatermass and A for Andromeda, but it did look for a while as if they were going to make a regular habit of these productions.
Well, according to the DVD extras on the new A for Andromeda, that was their intention to continue on with it, and apparently they had other candidates. I don't know what they were.
Right.
But it does not seem that they did continue with those.
Yeah, 2005 Quatermass, 2006 A for Andromeda, and now 3 years, nothing since. Oh, well.
Now, getting into some of our opinions and feelings about this, I think you get the idea that this hard science fiction is something that that I certainly enjoy. And I really enjoyed A for Andromeda. And as we've alluded to, the original serial now exists on DVD in this reconstruction, which is a little bit hard to watch. And it was clearly, because of these episodes, it's quite a long serial. So it is a bit of a long watch and a little bit awkward to look at some parts of it, especially in the beginning. But it really is very good and very much worth it. It was such an interesting story in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, the story is fascinating. I mean, I first came across A for Andromeda in a radio version when the book was read on the radio. And it's only recently that I've been able to actually watch the DVDs and see the reconstructions. As you say, there's quite a lot of stuff to get through. It's certainly it's words and ideas more than action. And there's an awful lot of exposition to be got through as we work through the story and we work through the project and we work through the various experiments that the supercomputer is leading the team through. But the ideas behind it are absolutely fascinating. It's great stuff.
Yes, they are. And when we do have actual action there, as you have in some of the later parts of the show, particularly episode 6 and 7, some of it is very strong. I really enjoyed Peter Halliday's performance as Dr. Fleming. And of course, Julie Christie also had a wonderful performance as Andromeda. So despite the fact that we were missing these things, the parts that we could see were really very good.
Right. Now, you see, this is where we're going to differ slightly, because unfortunately, I wasn't quite so pleased with Peter Halliday and Julie Christie.
Okay.
In the bits that survive. I mean, we love Peter Halliday because he's going to turn up as a Doctor Who regular over the years, but he didn't quite do it for me as Fleming in this particular series. And then Julie Christie, although she looks absolutely fabulous, she was, I think, quite specifically given the instructions by the director to play Andromeda almost as a sort of automaton, very sort of emotionless, with this very sort of monotone speech. And I actually preferred it when Susan Hampshire turned up and the character became slightly more human.
Right. There was a transition there with Julie Christie in A for Andromeda of her becoming more human towards the end. And I liked how that was handled. I also enjoyed the more inhuman parts of it as well.
Yes, yeah.
And Halliday brought that sense of commitment to his ideals and to the idea that there was a problem with obeying and working with everything the computer said to do without questioning it.
He's the moral center of A for Andromeda. But I mean, perhaps part of the problem is that he's given so much to say. He is given so much plot to actually discuss and to keep telling us about the morals of what they're doing and what they perhaps shouldn't be doing. But also, as you say, I mean, it's sort of like the way he gradually humanizes Andromeda is quite effective when that works. And the bits that have survived that are quite good. Unfortunately, there are bits of Julie Christie's performance where she does seem extremely wooden, despite the fact that that's actually, I think she'd been told to be wooden by the director.
Yeah, yeah. If I were going to point out weaknesses with this, and also with the Andromeda breakthrough, it would be that the episode length and number of episodes is awfully long.
Yeah.
So going with 7 45-minute episodes for the first one and 6 45-minute episodes for the second one, while it does allow them to get a lot of these ideas and interesting things into it, it was a lot of time to fill.
Mm.
And that was a little awkward in some ways and a little bit padded in some ways too.
Yeah.
Just to give you some perspective, we're talking about things that are about as long as or even a little longer than the very longest Doctor Who serials from the 1960s, which in their shorter episodes, those Doctor Who serials were 10 and 12 episodes. They only did a couple of them. So here we're going to things that are even a little longer than that, and they're more a single story as opposed to something that was almost like a chain of stories in some of those very long Doctor Who serials. So we're talking about things that are very long indeed, and maintaining story over something that's that long is difficult.
They're also, I think they're suffering from BBC budget as well. They have very little budget, I think, in either version, both in the 1960s version and in the 2006 remake. In fact, if anything, I think the 1960s version does more with their budget than the modern remake.
Yes, I think that's true. I don't think the budgets hampered them that much, certainly not in the 60s, because they were able to use these real locations, and they were working with something that was based on ideas and characters, so they were able to do a lot with what they had.
Yes, they make more of it in the 60s version, I think. They were used to making more from less, in a way.
You'll make one hell of an impression. Then you already have, haven't you? There'll be no holding you now, will there? He'll probably ask you to take over number 10. I suppose you think we'll all sleep easy in our beds now you've shown us all how powerful you are. I suppose you think we're all fools.
You are not a fool.
Look, if I weren't a fool, you wouldn't be here now. You shoot down a little bit of metal from the sky. It's a pushover when you know how. And suddenly you're in a commanding position.
That was intended.
Have you told them?
Of course not.
And what is intended next?
It depends on the program.
Yeah, you're a slave, aren't you?
Why don't you go?
Go?
Now, while you can.
What did you think of the Andromeda breakthrough, Eamon?
I mean, we had the distinct advantage of being able to watch it, which was a big help. But I did get the feeling that they were stretching the story out because they were obviously desperate to find a sequel.
Yes, I agree that it was stretched out and padded to make it to those 6 45-minute episodes. I did quite enjoy it, though. It changed from the sort of straight, this is about the science and the process and the ideas, to certainly including many of those ideas and many new ideas, but it evolved to something that was like a political thriller.
Yeah.
And felt like the early 1960s equivalent of a Bourne Identity kind of movie or something like that.
Yeah.
But with these computer and alien intelligence kinds of ideas in them that were so involved and so complex.
Yeah. I mean, if they'd got it down to maybe a 4 or 5 part series, it would have been a lot snappier. But there's great stuff in there. I mean, Susan Hampshire, I think, as we've said repeatedly, her sort of gradual humanization of Andromeda is good. And Mary Morris as Dawnay is just fantastic. I think she's an amazing presence on screen whenever she turns up in the 60s.
Yes, absolutely. Mary Morris as Madeline Dawnay in both A for Andromeda and the Andromeda Breakthrough, she was very good and very captivating. She was a very convincing character.
Can I just mention the Contact comparison?
It's hard not to, in a way.
Yes. Well, I mean, I saw this film again recently, Contact, a film starring Jodie Foster, which, again, I mean, you know, bizarrely, based on a novel by a famous astrophysicist, in this case Carl Sagan, about a signal that's picked up by a radio telescope, which instructs a group of scientists to construct a rather mysterious machine, the function of which is not entirely clear. And then later on in the story, it turns out that I think it's a sort of reclusive billionaire has built a duplicate machine in another part of the world to carry on the experiments. And it's quite amazing the similarities between Contact and the far earlier A for Andromeda.
I think it's fairly unlikely that Carl Sagan knew very much, if anything, about A for Andromeda, because after the broadcasts in the 60s, it was just not that well known. But I think the similarities between A for Andromeda and Contact are not as big as they first sound. You know, if you give a capsule description of, you know, scientists picking up a message from space that gives them instructions to build a mysterious machine, it, you know, it makes it sound very similar. But I think when you actually look at the movie and television versions and the novels, they are very different stories.
Yeah.
And they take quite different points of view as well.
Mm. I mean, you know, Carl Sagan must have known the scientific work of Fred Hoyle, but as you say, it seems extremely unlikely that he'd know the science fiction work and a slightly obscure 1960s BBC production that probably wasn't shown overseas. So it's just another one of those strange British invaders coincidences that we've come across, a bit like the Omega Factor turning up later on in very similar form as the X-Files.
That's right. And I believe the original A for Andromeda and the Andromeda Breakthrough were only broadcast once on the BBC. I'm not aware of any later broadcasts or any foreign broadcasts. Yeah. If any of our listeners know of other broadcasts, please let us know. I'd be interested to hear about that.
Yeah, we'd be fascinated to know. And we'd also be fascinated to hear if you've read the books. We've already had a very useful comment from Tony on the Facebook group. If you've read the novels or if you remember it being featured as Book of the Week on Radio 4, do let us know.
Yes, I have heard some very good things about the novels. I think I may have to follow those up and read them.
So, A for availability, Brian.
Well, as we've mentioned a number of times now, A for Andromeda did not survive the destruction of so many of the BBC's archives, and of course it happened at many other places as well as the BBC. It was thought to be basically completely lost. Before 2005, there was very little available or an archive for A for Andromeda. But a private collector had a copy of episode 6, although it did not include the framing device with Dr. Reiner in the interview describing things as they happened. So episode 6 was recovered. The telesnaps, which are these photos of the screen as it was broadcast that were done professionally by John Cura, the telesnaps were recovered. The director had a copy. And there were some clips, quite a few clips, and audio that were also rediscovered.
So the BBC took these various discoveries, and quite quickly, in 2006, they released a Region 2 DVD box set called the Andromeda Anthology, and that's three DVDs, and what you get are the captioned telesnap reconstructions of episodes 1 to 5. So as you say, Brian, that's the telesnaps, but with on-screen captions telling us what's happening.
And only music. Unlike the reconstructions of Doctor Who, we don't have audio for this.
Right.
So we just have background music with telesnaps and captions for much of it.
There's a few surviving clips that are sort of intercut along the way. Then we've got just about all of episode 6, but as you say, without the introductory interview sequence. And then we have a telesnap reconstruction of the final episode 7, but then we have about the last 15 minutes of that has survived as well. So again, on the DVD, you can get to see the last 15 minutes of the first series. And then on the rest of the DVDs, you have the entire sequel, the Andromeda Breakthrough, which has survived intact. And then there's some other bits and pieces on the DVDs. There's a few commentaries. There's the original scripts. And there's a short documentary about about A for Andromeda. And that's still available on Amazon here in the UK in Region 2. At the moment, that's about £12, but it's also available on all the rental sites over here in the UK.
Yes, they did a very good job on the Andromeda Anthology set. The reconstruction is quite good considering what they had to work with. And as it turns out, the further you get through the story, the more content they have. The one thing that was unfortunate was that a full set of audio for episode 7, I believe, was also rediscovered, but that was after the DVD set was released, so that audio is not there. But you do have a pretty good representation of the last chunk of the serial and a reconstruction that fills in the beginning fairly well. And there are also copies of all of the scripts on that DVD, so if you want to read the scripts, they are there in PDF format. In addition, there is also a DVD on Region 2 of the 2006 remake of A for Andromeda, which has some extra features, and it's a full modern DVD like we would expect. And in addition, the Italian A Com Andromeda is also available on a Region 2 DVD, alas, with no English subtitles. But all of those, the anthology and the 2006 remake and the Italian version, are all currently available, and they're all on Region 2, and they're all live, easy to get hold of.
And as we've said, also fairly easy to get hold of are the various editions of the two books, A for Andromeda and the Andromeda Breakthrough, which have had lots of editions over the years, and the A for Andromeda is still in print itself at the moment. But as I say, the previous editions fairly easy to get hold of on Amazon and other online book sites.
I believe some of the editions of the novel were actually edited down to be a little bit shorter, so you may want to double check which version of the novel you're getting to see that you have the whole thing.
Yes, I think there are some abridged, almost, I think, school reader copies, particularly of A for Andromeda, to watch out for.
And it has to be said, there are no Region 1 releases of any version of A for Andromeda. So if you don't import DVDs and play them on a region-free player when you're in North America, you'll have to settle for the books.
No Region 1, I'm afraid, Brian.
So we should give our recommendations, although I think we've given most of them already. This is really interesting stuff. I enjoyed all of the programs on the Andromeda Anthology. I also enjoyed the remake, although in many ways I thought that it lost something from the original. But I would certainly recommend that these are worth getting a hold of, perhaps for rental if you really want to get them to hang on to them. But there is some very interesting stuff if you're interested in older black and white science fiction television.
Yes, and as we said, if you're interested in the sort of harder science fiction approach as well, this is fascinating stuff. And the thing about A for Andromeda is the great ideas that are contained within. I would have to say, unfortunately, that it is, as it exists currently, quite a tough watch, because watching captioned telesnaps reconstructions for the first 5 episodes is hard work, and it's not tremendously enjoyable. It's quite nice when the surviving bits and pieces and the surviving episode 6 come along, because they're much more entertaining. And I think just because of that reason, I'm actually going to recommend, if you haven't got the time to try the whole 7 episodes of the original, I would go for the 90-minute remake from 2006 to give you a fair introduction to the ideas of A for Andromeda. If you're really interested in the black and white original, then it's worth chasing those and tracking those down and investing the time in those.
And if you understand Italian, you can rent the Italian version and email us to let us know how it is.
Yes, do somebody please tell us about the Italian version and whether it's good.
So, in summary, A for Andromeda was a 1960s TV serial that was about the reception of an alien signal that gave instructions that allowed people to build this incredibly powerful computer, which itself gave more instructions and guidance to be able to create a living person. And all kinds of things ensue about what this means and what the intentions of the computer and the alien intelligence and Andromeda, the young woman that it created, about what those intentions of all of them were. There was also a sequel which continues on from that and is a bit more of a political thriller, but includes many of the original ideas and some new ones as well. So there is a very rich, complex, interesting type of show there.
So next time on British Invaders, we'll be discussing a series called Beasts, which was a 1976 sort of horror anthology series written by another British Invaders favourite, Nigel Neal. So some interesting stuff to talk about next time when we get to this strange show called Beasts.
Nigel Neal, of course, was the creator of Quatermass. And on British Invaders, as well as straight science fiction series, we like to talk about all the related genres, and we've done fantasy series a few times, and we've even done a little bit of speculative documentary. This will be our first time going into horror, in the sort of psychological horror, which is really quite neat. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We also have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there.
And by popular demand, we are now putting up the next 3 subjects for our schedule on the Facebook group, so you can now see what we're going to be discussing over the next 3 months, including already a pre-show discussion on the subject of Nigel Neal's Beasts. So if you've seen that show, or if you've even heard of that show, please do come onto the Facebook group and find us and let us know what you think about it or what you've heard about it so far.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yep, thank you very much indeed for listening, and do join us next time. And this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.